Welcome, everyone, to the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and this is episode 77, Developing Frameworks for Virtual Learning. Our essential question for this episode is, how can we develop common vocabulary and expectations for virtual learning quickly, well, and without further burdening teachers? See, typically, we have lots of shared expectations in place for teachers, right? You have your teacher evaluation criteria, you have your curriculum, you have your standards, you have your district expectations, departmental agreements, school level agreements and expectations, you have professional development and training that people have been through and that have become a part of your body of shared expectations and shared vocabulary for talking about teaching practice. And I don't know exactly the situation in your district right now, but I'm going to guess that that norm, that history, that shared expectation that has been developed is somewhat out of sorts right now, that there's some sort of disruption in some way based on the pandemic that we're in the midst of, whether that means that you are starting the year all virtual, whether that means you are all in person, but students are taking different precautions and teachers are taking different precautions and working together in different ways. I am going to guess that things are a bit different in terms of the situation that teaching and learning is taking place in. And for our work as instructional leaders, we have got to be not just aware of, but responsive to the circumstances that teachers are working under. Because if we're going to have feedback conversations with teachers about their practice and help them identify what's working well, do more of what's working well, figure out maybe what's not working so well or what might be working fine, but it's just too much work. I think that's a really big issue right now. We have got to be able to talk about those practices using some shared vocabulary and some common expectations. And if you've been following the Instructional Leadership Show for a while, if you have been through the Instructional Leadership Challenge, or you've maybe attended some of our webinars in the past, or read my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership, you know that we have a specific term for that set of shared expectations that you use in your school to talk about practice. And that is an instructional framework. Now, ordinarily, a lot of your instructional framework is specified by, say, the Danielson framework, or you might have a district instructional framework or a state instructional framework. So often we don't really have to mess with this too much on a day-to-day basis. We have lots of different possible sources beyond the teacher evaluation criteria. You have state policy, state law, district policy. You have your curriculum. You have the different trainings you've been to. You have the research that's been done, the books that have been published. And typically those change very slowly, right? Research develops over a very long period of time. Policy changes fairly slowly. So these aren't things that we really have to pivot very quickly and react to. And that's, for the most part, a good thing. But right now, when teachers are teaching under dramatically different circumstances than perhaps they ever have before, we need to be able to develop shared expectations and shared vocabulary for talking about teaching practice much more quickly. Researchers are not going to help us. They will, in the future, they will have found some things that turned out to have worked. Books are being published at a rapid pace, and you're seeing those come out all the time about virtual learning and things like that. But for the most part, we're on our own as a profession. You, on the front lines, are among the best people to figure this out, to figure out what works, and to help people do more of what works across your organization. And I say that you're in the best position to figure this out because you are there. You are able to do the single most important thing that needs to be done to figure out how we can be effective, and that is to simply notice. When you are getting into classrooms, whether that's virtually or in person, if you will simply notice what teachers are doing, that is the first and most powerful step. We have to be there, virtually or in person, to see what teachers are doing and ask ourselves, okay, when I see this lesson, I see the teacher's prep that they've put in, I see the reaction or non-reaction in terms of student response, I can ask myself, what's working? What's not working about this? Where are we maybe putting something out there for students and then getting crickets, no response from kids? You know, it's critical that we learn from that experience rapidly right now so that we can do more of what's working, less of what's not, and free up time for our teachers. And so that when we see a big difference in what's working for one teacher and maybe some things that are not working for another teacher, we can connect those dots and we can say, okay, here is the pathway from not working in this one classroom to working, what this other teacher is doing. And we can transfer that learning internally, even without the support of any articles, even without the support of any researchers, even without strategies from a book. We can engage in this professional learning. And to be honest, we have to, right? We have no choice. Right now, we have to learn as a profession to get this right. And fortunately, I think we have ample evidence being generated right now in classrooms across the profession. Every classroom is an experiment. And in one sense, it's kind of unfortunate that we didn't have better coordination at the beginning of this and say, okay, hey, everybody, here's what virtual learning is going to look like. Here are the best practices and all the research from the schools that have been doing virtual learning for a long time. And here's how it's going to be different for your kids who aren't opting into virtual learning but have no choice. You know, if we knew exactly what to do ahead of time, maybe that would be better. But I also think the lack of extreme coordination, you know, the lack of a completely top-down system is a good thing because it's allowed us and really forced us to conduct thousands and thousands of parallel experiments, right? We have over, 3 million teachers in the profession in the United States alone. And for the most part, schools are figuring this out on their own. And that generates an enormous amount of experimental evidence. We have an enormous amount of evidence about what's working and what's not. It's just, we have to gather that evidence, right? If people are doing their own thing on their own, figuring this out for themselves, they're going to figure it out, but it's going to be slower and it's not going to benefit other classrooms, other teachers, and other students if we don't find a way to share that learning. And that, my friend, is where you, as an instructional leader, play a critical role. So I'm going to assume that if you are joining us on the Instructional Leadership Show, that you are in some sort of role. I'm going to assume that perhaps you are a central office administrator, maybe a superintendent. Perhaps you are an instructional coach and you support teachers either within one school or maybe across several schools. Maybe you are the curriculum director and you're in charge of professional development for all schools in your district. Or maybe you are an admin intern and you're trying to figure out what to do with yourself for your internship now that we're in this kind of a very strange season. Or perhaps, like the majority of our members, you are a principal or assistant principal who supervises teachers and wants to help people become more effective. You, my friend, play a critical role in facilitating this learning across our profession. So as we have these thousands of parallel experiments taking place across the profession in all these different classrooms, all these different schools, we have the opportunity to learn from one another if you do that work of noticing what's working and starting to put some thoughts down on paper. See, here's why I think this is exciting. If we had that top-down consistency, if there was just one plan and everybody was going to do the same thing, we would get consistency, but we wouldn't necessarily get the best quality, right? The way we have it set up now, where everybody can kind of do their own thing, or at least every district and or every school can do their own thing, it doesn't necessarily generate the greatest degree of consistency, and it doesn't create maybe the highest degree of quality overall, but it does maximize our opportunity to learn if we will take advantage of that. And overall, I believe that with that setup, we can end up much better off than if we'd just been top down from the beginning, or if we just left people completely to do their own thing. And I think the key ingredient there is organizational learning. Hey, welcome, Samantha. Thanks so much for tuning in here. And let me know if you're watching this live or watching it later on social media. I'd love to hear from you and hear your thoughts about this. But we are talking today about the idea of an instructional framework. And you might have found that some aspects of your normal expectations for teachers just kind of apply awkwardly or don't apply very well when there are so many things that are happening differently with virtual learning. But I believe some of the fundamentals are every bit as true as they usually are. When you have a high-quality instructional framework in place, it can serve as the third party in your feedback conversations with teachers. And what I mean by that is that if you are sitting across the table or across the Zoom meeting from a teacher and you're talking about what you saw in the classroom and you're starting to get to maybe not evaluative conclusions, but you're starting to make sense of what you saw and compare that with expectations. If the only two sources of those expectations are my opinion and the teacher's opinion, it can become a little bit of a battle of wills. And our incentives there, you know, I want to look tough, I want to help you improve, I want to raise the bar, and you want to become, you want to demonstrate competence, you want to show that you meet standard. You know, there's this kind of inevitable butting of heads that happens there. But if we have a third party in the room, if we have a neutral, standard bearer, if we have that instructional framework there that can serve as our expectations, instead of butting heads, what we can do is triangulate. We can look at those shared expectations and look at the evidence that's in front of us and say, well, where are we with this? You know, how did this go based on what we see and based on the shared expectations that are in our framework? If you've never had a conversation like that, I just can't express to you how powerful it is to not be the source of those expectations yourself, not just to have you be the bad guy, so to speak, but to have those expectations be outside of yourself, outside of the teacher's own opinion, and a shared third party expectation. When we do that, when we use a framework like that, we also get a common vocabulary. And we can't underestimate how powerful that is either, to be speaking the same language, not just the same buzzwords, but the same meaning and the same specificity when we talk about using a particular practice. When we truly know what the other person means, these conversations can be much more fruitful. When we have that language, not just to provide definitions, but to provide levels of performance, as you might have in your teacher evaluation framework, you also get a roadmap or a growth pathway so that if someone is not where they need to be, instead of just telling them, well, just do more of all these things, here's a checklist of best practices, just do more of all of those, we can actually look at the qualitative descriptions on that rubric and say, you know what, it looks like we're at a level two here. This is what I'm seeing in your classroom, or this is the kind of work that I'm seeing your students do. And we can look in the other columns of the rubric and say, here's where we want to go next. This is our next destination. And just the self-efficacy that comes from that, when teachers can see, all right, here's where I am, I've already grown, and here's the next step for me, people believe in themselves when they see that their colleagues are already doing those kinds of things, that they are already partway down the road, and they believe that they can make that progress. And I think that's what we especially need to see when all of this is new for people, you know, when maybe using technology is threatening to a lot of people, it's difficult for some people, even if they've been very comfortable with their regular teaching practices for many years. We have got to make it easier for people to grow and to know what they're growing toward. And an instructional framework can make all the difference for that. Now, I would love to say that I have one for you and that you can just buy it, or I'll make it free on the website, or you can just print it out and hand it out to your teachers. But here is the thing. Like, I'm a big fan of the Danielson framework and Kim Marshall's framework, and James Strong has a framework, and there are lots of different frameworks for different things, and they're fabulous. I don't want to discourage you from using any of those. But here's the thing for this moment in history right now is these need to be district specific. They need to be tailored to your organization. Because, once upon a time, a classroom was a classroom, a chemistry lab was a chemistry lab, a second grade classroom was a second grade classroom, a PE class was a PE class, and there weren't just enormous differences in context, right? Now, different communities are different, different schools have a different culture, but there is a reason that Charlotte Danielson was able to make a rubric that applies to all teachers in all times and all places, because we had some common assumptions in place about what those classrooms would look like. And with virtual learning, a lot of those common assumptions have to go out the window, right? You might be doing live synchronous classes. You might be doing mostly asynchronous work in Canvas or Google Classroom. You might have playlists of videos for students to watch and get explanations from. You might be using game-based software to teach kids math and explain concepts. You might have, I saw an article the other day that I didn't even know this was happening, but teachers teaching live lessons to students in their classroom and also live streaming those lessons through some sort of conferencing platform to students at home and having an earpiece in and listening to questions from students on Zoom and also listening to questions from kids in the room. Like, this varies greatly from one organization to another. And if I were to make a rubric for everybody. Everybody would say, you know what, this doesn't actually apply to my situation. So I think the big opportunity here is for you to develop those expectations in-house at the district or organizational level where the conditions are what you have in common, right? I'm going to guess that you have a degree of autonomy within your school. Teachers have a degree of autonomy within their classrooms, but certain key decisions have been made at the district level about how people will work together, where information will be posted, how students will log in, and you know, kind of what expectations and protocols are in place there. And those get shared with families as agreements. You know, this is how virtual learning works. This is what you're signing up for. This is what we're able to offer you. And alignment across the organization with those expectations is absolutely key. So some of that toward the beginning of the year focused on logistics. You know, here's your login. Here's the platform we're using. Here's the technology that we will be using. But I think the alignment conversation now needs to shift toward practice. It needs to shift toward pedagogy so that we can focus on improvement. And often when we think about improvement, what we first try to do is we try to make a plan, or we try to make a document, or we try to make a committee that will meet and discuss how to make a plan and put it into a document. Like we're very document oriented when it comes to any kind of shared expectations and improvement. And I think because of the pressures that everyone is under right now, especially classroom teachers who may be teaching students at home and students who are there in person, or maybe that's changing in the next couple of weeks, I think we need to implement the no extra paperwork rule. In fact, if you can eliminate paperwork that teachers currently have to do, if you can say, you know what, we've been doing this, you know, lesson plan requirement or unit plans, or you have to turn in your PLC logs or whatever, even if you can eliminate, an existing paperwork requirement, absolutely do it. And certainly do not give teachers more paperwork to do. Do not say, hey, please meet with your team and develop an instructional framework for me and we'll put them all together and make something great. No, making documents needs to be our last priority and not our first priority. We should really protect teachers' time. I believe very strongly teachers are more overwhelmed than they have ever been in their careers during my lifetime. And paperwork and documents and committees and all of that, we just really need to avoid that and figure out how we can get on the same page, how we can develop shared expectations and create alignment across the district and maximize the impact of our organizational learning without creating a bunch of committees and documents. Does that sound good? Does that sound like a plan? All right, here I promised I would give you some quick tips for how to do that. And this is just kind of a high level, conceptual overview of what we're talking about doing here. First of all, notice what teachers are doing. I have been challenging you to get into classrooms, you know, for years now, and specifically this year, I've been challenging you to get into conversations with teachers. If you go to principalcenter.com/conversations, I've got one here on my phone. You can kind of see the sticker there. You can get a 500 conversations sticker at principalcenter.com/conversations. We'll send you one of those to remind you to get into conversations with teachers, because you know that's where we make sense of what we see and what we're noticing. And especially if it's difficult to really get a sense of what teaching is like when it's happening virtually or happening in a hybrid format, or you know, you're slammed with all this new work, it's especially important to make time to talk with people and notice what they're doing, consider multiple forms of evidence, look at not just the teaching performance, the sage on the stage kind of thing, but the artifacts and the resources and the learning management system. You know, there are lots of different forms of evidence that we don't normally worry about that I think are highly relevant to teacher practice and understanding it right now. So we need to notice, we need to talk about it, and then we need to start organizing some of our thoughts around that into draft rubrics. And this, my friend, can be super simple. Give yourself one sheet of paper, or maybe you have a section at the back of your planner. I picked up this planner at the bookstore the other day. We have a planner, by the way, for our Instructional Leadership Association members. That'll be coming in your email tomorrow for October and the rest of the year, your planner template. Somewhere, just start taking some notes here. This planner has graph paper at the back where I could just kind of sketch some notes about what I'm seeing. And maybe I start to identify some categories. Like maybe I'm starting to think differently about student engagement. What does student engagement look like given the way that we're teaching right now? Maybe we're doing live Zoom classes, or maybe we're doing, you know, we post a video and students post their work. Based on what you're doing, what does student engagement look like? or what does formative assessment look like, or what does creating meaningful group work for students look like? Whatever dimensions are jumping out to you as the most relevant and the biggest opportunities for improvement, start taking some notes on those and organize those notes into some categories. And if you go into one classroom or you're looking at the work of one teacher and you think, you know what, this is really exemplary. This is just impressive how much this teacher is able to do with his or her students. And then you go and look at another teacher's practice and you say, this is kind of minimal. This is not super great. That contrast is a key source of learning. It is absolutely essential that we look at the variations from one classroom to another and figure out how to kind of arrange those into a growth pathway. So if this person over here is doing something that's not very effective, and this person over here just seems like they're from another planet, just doing something that's amazing, knocking it out of the park, I've got to figure out, how do we get this person over here closer to that other planet where great things are happening? And you can start to fill in that roadmap for yourself in the form of a rubric. Don't overcomplicate this. Again, give yourself a single sheet of paper and just start taking notes. Don't form a committee. Don't form a task force. Don't create a Google Doc for your entire staff and put one more thing on their plates. This needs to start with you noticing and taking notes and talking with teachers about what you're seeing and then revising. And I promise some big trends will emerge very quickly if you're disciplined about getting into classrooms or observing teacher practice in whatever form it's taking, and if you talk with teachers about their practice. This will happen very, very quickly. And then don't publish a document. Don't say, hey, I made this up. Everybody give me feedback on it. Instead of sending out the actual document, just start using that framework in whatever draft form it's in conversation with teachers, and start to use some of the same language over and over again. Start to use some of that same language in your newsletter. Start to use some of that same language in your virtual faculty meetings. Whatever formats you have for talking with teachers, for communicating with your staff, start to use that language and get yourself more clear and systematic on what you're looking for. Now, down the road, will we bring teachers into that conversation in a more deliberate way? Yes. I think we need to stick with the no extra paperwork rule for now. But what we can't do is say as a blanket statement or as a blanket rule that we're just not going to improve until people aren't overwhelmed anymore. I don't think we can do that, my friend, because the reality is our students need us to improve instruction now. It is a mess in a lot of places. And the good news about that variation from classroom to classroom is, for every classroom that's kind of a mess where students aren't really engaged and the teacher doesn't really know what to do to change that, you also have shining stars. You have an example within the same school, within the same district, of someone who is knocking it out of the park. And that creates the opportunity for you to notice the difference, for you as an instructional leader to articulate the difference and to pave that pathway so that everyone can improve and that you can develop shared expectations that bring everyone forward in their practice. So I hope that is enough to get you started at least. I want to let you know what we're doing in the next couple of weeks. We're launching an all new program called Virtual Learning Framework. And at the district level, that document that we're not going to burden teachers with right now, but that we are going to get instructional leaders thinking about right now, that document is the outcome of our work at the district level. Now, again, the document does not need to come first. It's the thinking and the conversation and the alignment that come first, but we want to end up on the same page. And that page is the framework. So that's why we're calling this Virtual Learning Framework. And then within that, we have several key components. For teachers, we have an all new program coming called the Designing Engaging Virtual Learning Training. And Dr. Amy Bader will walk teachers through the process of designing an engaging virtual learning unit. And we even have a unit design template that people can use to structure their thinking and make sure they're hitting all the key points that are different as you plan a virtual unit versus an in-person unit. We have something that I'm very excited about for instructional leaders called the Virtual Instructional Leadership Challenge. And this will be the fifth complete overhaul. If you count the book itself as one version of the challenge, this will be the fifth complete from scratch rethinking and re-envisioning of what instructional leadership looks like in a virtual environment. So that will be included with the framework program. One thing that's a little bit unusual here is that this is a district level program. So normally you can sign up yourself as an individual. We have payment plans and things like that. Or you can sign up your school with the purchase order and get your admin team on board. We are purposefully doing this as a district level program because this alignment needs to take place at the district level. And we've made the decision to offer flat rate pricing so that districts of widely varying sizes, you know, can participate without having the per participant rates add up real quickly if you have a lot of administrators. We want everybody to be able to participate and be on board without a big expense. So we have flat rate pricing for districts. If you are in an independent school or a very small district, if the flat rate pricing is unaffordable just because of the size of your district, you can request a quote. Just let us know how many students you have, and we can get you a quote right away. In fact, I saw one of these come in right now, and since we've been live here. And we'll have more information about that over the next couple of weeks. But for now, what I want to encourage you to do is simply pay attention to what is working in your classrooms and pay attention to what's not working as well. If you see people struggling, if you see a lack of engagement, if you see confusion, if you see teachers feeling like what they're doing is working, but it's just so much that they can't sustain it, we have got to start taking notes on that and figure out how can we make this job more doable for people? How can we make this more sustainable? And how can we focus our efforts on what's going to be most impactful for our students? Because student learning, of course, has to be the bottom line. Find a place in your planner, find just a single sheet of copy paper if you want, and start turning some of those patterns of what you're seeing, of what's working and what's not working, into a one-page rubric. That is it for now. If you want to learn more about the Virtual Learning Framework program, you can go to principalcenter.com/framework, and we'll have details on the Virtual Instructional Leadership Challenge and how you can get your district signed up to participate there. But that is it for today. This has been episode 77 of the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you next time. Take care.